This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our series about inequality in the Baltimore region. Early in our series, we examined how housing policies throughout the 20th century contributed to the lines of race and class that still cut through our region today. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 included a mandate for the federal government to, quote, affirmatively further, unquote, fair housing, to help erase the lines between us, as it were. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has been criticized, however, for not using all of its power to compel communities to promote integrated housing in the four decades after the act was signed. A recent review of HUD, however, claims that it became, quote, re-energized, unquote, during President Obama's first term, although the review said much work remains to be done in enforcing the affirmative furthering of fair housing. The University of Maryland Carey School of Law is hosting a conference today called The Fair Housing Act at 45, Actualizing the Duty to Affirmatively Further Fair Housing. I'll be moderating a panel this afternoon. Many important fair housing issues will be covered throughout the day. We invited two of the conference's speakers to give us a preview of some of the developments that affect fair housing in the Baltimore region. Melody Taylor Blanchard is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Mid-Atlantic Regional Director for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. She joins us by phone from her office in Philadelphia. And Dan Pontius of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council joined me in the studio. He helps coordinate the region's approach to fair housing. And welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Welcome, Melody.
I'm here.
Melody, when it comes to fair housing, can you tell us quickly what it means to, quote, affirmatively further?
Certainly. From a department's perspective, affirmatively furthering it is about addressing discriminatory actions and undoing the past history of segregation. We believe that it's about removing barriers to fair housing choice and creating new ways to access housing choice. And it's a meaningful assessment of current behavior and past patterns of behavior that involve discrimination.
So give me an idea of how you know when a jurisdiction is affirmatively furthering and when it's not.
Some of the measures that we've taken, again, as you mentioned in your comments earlier, we've definitely enhanced our efforts in evaluating whether or not a jurisdiction is affirmatively furthering. And some of those things involve simply evaluating their analysis of impediments and whether or not they've conducted analysis of impediments as a first measure.
Analysis of impediments is a term of art, I gather, in this area of law. It's called the AI, and I gather it's something that you look at quite closely to see if a jurisdiction is zeroing in on what's keeping fair housing from being fair.
Absolutely. So we want to make sure that the jurisdiction is actually conducting an analysis of impediments. And in doing so, they have to take the protected class members into consideration. They have to look at race when evaluating that. They are required to look at census data and demographics and determine those communities that have the greatest need. And to look at those things that impact a person's ability to have fair housing choices, transportation, schools, patterns of segregation. Those are some of the things that we look at, and that they're taking appropriate actions to overcome the effects of any impediments identified through the analysis. And in doing so, that means they have to do meaningful fair housing planning. The other piece of that is that they have to maintain records reflecting the analysis and the actions taken to address the impediments.
And as I understand it, in enforcing this duty to affirmatively further, HUD can withhold funding to jurisdictions if they've failed. That's happened in Westchester County, New York, and in Joliet, Illinois. What else does HUD do to enforce this obligation to affirmatively further?
Vis-a-vis the Thompson settlement, which is in the Baltimore area, that was a case that was filed by public housing residents who wanted more desegregative housing choices for their families. And a few of the key elements of that settlement included the creation of the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Demonstration Project. And under that demonstration project, developers of housing who seek FHA mortgage insurance will receive lower insurance premiums for more frequent case distributions and other incentives.
Dan Pontius, I want to bring you in here. Is it because of that case, Thompson v. HUD, that we have a regional approach in this region?
I don't think it's entirely because of the Thompson case. We have local housing officials in the local jurisdictions that get their housing money straight from HUD who've decided a couple times now to undertake an analysis of impediments regionally, which is not required. Most jurisdictions just do one for their own jurisdiction. But we did one in 1996, which was about the time that the Thompson case was filed, and then one just that was finished just last year as well.
So this is a regional analysis of what is impeding fair housing.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our case, it's both, because in this past one that the local government's just completed, there is a section in the AI for each of the local governments, too. So they have very specific things that they need to take care of in their own jurisdictions. And then on top of that, there's a regional section that looks at regional things like transportation, like overall tax credit policy, that kind of thing, and how that influences our patterns of segregation.
What's the advantage of a regional approach?
Well, if you look at our residential patterns here in the Baltimore area, you can tell that the housing patterns, they don't stop at a jurisdiction's line. You know, Ruxton is very similar to Roland Park. You know, the Liberty Road corridor goes from Baltimore City into Baltimore County. So when you take a regional approach, you can see how broader policy issues influence all the jurisdictions.
Dan, in 1971, Baltimore County didn't have a public housing authority, and Robert Embry, who was then Baltimore City's Housing and Community Development Commissioner, proposed a policy to keep residents of surrounding counties out of city public housing. He told the Baltimore Sun he hoped his policy would, quote, encourage suburban areas to come up with ways to meet the needs of their own low-income residents rather than relying on Baltimore City to meet those needs, close quote. And that's been 40-some years. How has the landscape of fair housing changed among the jurisdictions since then?
Well, I think the fact that we have a regional analysis of impediments to fair housing choice shows that there's a lot more cooperation among the jurisdictions now than I guess there was 40 years ago. I mean, another step in our analysis of impediments, one of the steps that we need to take is to look at housing vouchers. So now there is public housing in particular places around the metropolitan area, but a lot of people are also able to use housing choice vouchers, which presumably would give them greater choice in where they can live. And one of the things we're doing is working with the public housing authorities around the region, including Baltimore County, which does administer vouchers, even though it doesn't have hard units of public housing, to try to make sure that there aren't impediments for people to be able to use their vouchers to live where they want to live.
That's Dan Pontius of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast, and also with us is Melody Taylor Blanchard of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We're talking about fair housing. Melody, as you know, the investigative news site ProPublica wrote a big piece about fair housing late last year, saying that President Nixon and all the presidents who followed declined, quote, to use the leverage of HUD's billions to fight segregation, unquote. But a recent review by the National Fair Housing Alliance and the Poverty and Race Research Action Council says there was, quote, significant enforcement, close quote, during President Obama's first term. And in fact, HUD seemed, quote, re-energized, end quote. But they also said there's a lot more work to do. So what's next for HUD in this realm?
I think what's next is that we stay the course with the work that we do, but we increase and we enhance. There has been a re-energized effort in ensuring that communities that receive federal dollars are affirmatively furthering fair housing. And in doing so, from a internal perspective, you know, nationwide, you know, we're required to up our efforts in terms of compliance reviews. And so the whole notion, again, as communities are required to do an analysis of impediments, the whole purpose of that process is to also, you know, have them evidence what they're doing. And so, you know, we're in the communities now. We're providing consultations to our grant recipients. We're increasing our collaborations internally with our community planning and development office. So, you know, some of those silos that have been created over the years are now being broken by our collective efforts to ensure that from a department's perspective that we are doing the work that the Fair Housing Act governs us to do. And that just doesn't happen under the Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. Each of our program offices are required to do so, and so we're working collectively with them to make that happen.
Dan, I want to ask you about the state of Maryland gets a certain amount of tax credits from the IRS every year to entice developers to create affordable housing. And the way the state administers that program is being revised. It's subject to public comment right now. Can you walk us through how it works?
Well, there is a set of requirements that developers need to meet in order to apply for these tax credits, which are now the largest source of affordable housing funding in the country. And then also every project that applies for these tax credits is scored based on a whole series of criteria, from, you know, the developer's experience to how much control they have over the site, things like that. And what our analysis of impediments said is that those tax credits are primarily being used in areas, they're primarily benefiting low-income families, minority families, and in many cases they're going to areas that already have a lot of low-income housing and could be exacerbating segregation in the region. And that's something, if you look at Westchester, that's exactly the problem that they had. A problem with placing affordable housing in ways that exacerbated segregation rather than reducing it, rather than affirmatively furthering fair housing.
In Westchester, New York.
Right. And so that's why our action plan directs us to urge the state to change the way that they allocate their tax credits. And so we've submitted a couple of rounds of comments now urging them to change that.
Change them in what way?
Well, in a couple of key ways. Currently, local governments need to pass a resolution to support the project, any project that's applying for tax credits, even if they already have the zoning. You know, if otherwise they could build as of right, and the local governments don't need to give any reason. So our analysis of impediments said that could impede fair housing, and so we've asked them to drop that requirement that local governments approve a project or even have the ability to disapprove it without giving any particular reason.
So that's a vote that's required in the state's method for distributing these tax credits. It's not a vote that's required in the charters of these counties.
That's correct. And another, there's a score, as I mentioned, there's a scoring process, and right now it's easier to get a higher score to put your project in a lower income community than it is to put it in a higher income community. And so we first asked that a certain set of these tax credits be set aside for higher opportunity areas around the region, places with better schools that people in low-income housing don't always have access to. And we recently asked them just to equalize the point scoring so that they wouldn't be weighted one way or the other. You know, we don't have covenants where communities can freeze out different races of people in their communities anymore. But there are these little policy angles to how our housing resources are spent that for whatever reason can influence our racial patterns. You know, so that's what this analysis of impediments is really designed to do, is to look around and say, you know, whether we're trying to or not, what are the current barriers that still exist that reinforce the levels of segregation that once were enforced by public policy, and what can we do as local governments and state governments to bring down those barriers so that we can truly have housing that's open to all.
Melody, is this an issue that HUD will weigh in on or has weighed in on, or is this essentially something that the jurisdictions and the state here in Maryland will work out?
Currently, there was a complaint filed with our office. And so I'm not at liberty to speak completely about that, but at some point HUD will participate in evaluating that.
This series is about inequality, and there have been periodic flare-ups of resentment when opportunities have opened for low-income people in more affluent areas. I'm thinking of Move to Opportunity in the 90s, a program in the 90s that moved inner-city residents, and sometimes battles over the source of income when resentment of Section 8 families. Dan Pontius, do you feel like there are race and class issues that the region has not addressed that impede the integration of our communities?
Sure. I mean, there are always those tensions. It's interesting. I mean, another item on our action plan list is the fact that landlords right now can decide whether or not to take a tenant solely based on whether or not they have a housing choice voucher, without considering, you know, whether their income is steady enough or whether their previous references or things like that. Just because they have a voucher, they can say, "Oh, I'm not going to rent to you because you have a voucher." And the bill in the state legislature to make source of income a protected class, to say that you can no longer just decide solely based on a voucher whether or not to rent to somebody, got out of the committee, passed the committee this year, and failed by one vote on the floor of the Senate. So I think we're making progress on these issues, and sure, there continue to be tensions. I don't think you can say that all those tensions are past us now. And I think what the analysis of impediments says is that we have to be looking every few years. You need to do an analysis of where are those elements in our society, whether they're public policies or understanding in the private sector. Part of our action plan is educating realtors and landlords, housing professionals, on how to do their duty to abide by the fair housing rules as well. And we need to, it's a counterforce to all those, to those pressures that might push us still in the direction to keep those lines between us and to try to break them down.
Melody, is it fair to ask you, when with your mid-Atlantic focus, how you feel the Baltimore region is doing?
I think it's a fair question. Again, you know, I think we're improving. And I think as a result of the education and the outreach that the Baltimore Center has done and continues to do, and the collaborations that office has created, you know, increases the opportunities. Recently, we had some evidence, for example, that Anne Arundel County last year completed their first new affordable family housing development in 10 years. So again, you know, we're work in progress, and we're better today than we were 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, thank you both for taking time to talk to us. Thanks.
Sure. It's been great to be here.
Thank you.
Melody Taylor Blanchard is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Mid-Atlantic Regional Director for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. Dan Pontius is with the Baltimore Metropolitan Council. They're both among the panelists at today's conference on fair housing at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. It's sold out, but you can find information about it at our website, linesbetweenus.org. The state of Maryland is in the midst of revising its Qualified Allocation Plan. That's the program that uses tax credits to encourage developers to create low and middle-income housing. The state has already gotten public comment on the first draft. Another draft is scheduled to be released next week, and the deadline for public comment on that draft is April 29th. We have the latest version of the plan at linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on The Lines Between Us, we talk with the filmmakers behind the documentary The Central Park Five about the wrongful conviction of five Black and Latino youths in a high-profile case. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. In 1989, five Black and Latino teenagers in New York were indicted and then wrongfully convicted of raping a white 28-year-old investment banker named Tricia Mealy while she was jogging in Central Park. The teens served 5 to 7 years in jail before being exonerated for that crime. Sarah Burns and her husband, David McMahon, along with Sarah's father, Ken Burns, made a documentary about the case called The Central Park Five. We screened the film at Micah's Brown Center in January as part of the Maryland Film Festival WYPR Spotlight Series. After the screening, I spoke with filmmakers Sarah Burns and David McMahon, as well as Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five. I began by asking Sarah Burns to tell us how the Central Park Five were convicted of a crime they didn't commit.
Yeah, it's a terrifying story, and it's not an isolated one, I would add, but I think it's a particularly egregious example of how wrongful convictions happen. I think there are a lot of factors. One was that New York was a place that was afraid at that time. It was a different city than it is now, and I think that people reacted in a certain way to this narrative of the crime that was presented by the police. There are the coerced confessions by detectives, certain they had the right suspects and willing to sort of do whatever it took to get confessions. And then you have the media and a public sort of willing to buy this story of these kids as animals, as predators, without asking any questions, without bringing any skepticism to this story, even when there's no DNA evidence, no other forensic evidence, and these confessions don't actually make any sense. People just ran with this story and they believed it.
Raymond Santana, it is unimaginable for us to conceive of what it must have been like for you to have lived through this experience. Are you mad as hell? Are you bitter? How are you now, some, 13 years after this began to unfold, this story?
Well, you know, when you look at this case and you see how it played out, you know, if I was bitter, then it would be understandable. But what happens is that early on, we learned, the five of us, we learned that to be bitter, you know, can eat you from the inside out, and it can take you to the grave. And so what happened was that we decided not to be bitter. We decided to channel that energy and to focus into something more positive, which is turning the Central Park 5 label into something that, you know, can go on and live on its own, you know, something more positive. And this is the reason why we decided to do the film, because back in 1989, you know, we were 14, 15, 16 years old. Nobody wanted to invest in us. And so we felt by giving back to the kids, this is how we invest in them. And so, you know, we knew that bitterness, you can't deal with that. You got to let that go. And that's how you grow, you know, by letting it go. And we know that there's something much more at stake here, and that's these kids. You know, these are our future doctors, our future lawyers. You know, one of you kids might do my divorce papers. I don't know, you know. I mean, you never know. You know, I might need you to help me some way, somehow. And so, you know, we have to take initiative, invest into them. And that's how we did it, by making this film.
That sounds right. That sounds good. But it also sounds remarkable to be able to actually do that and to actually not harbor, you know, real hate and anger towards the people, the many people who did this to you.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem that we really have is that at the end of the day, we can't move forward. You know, this case has been pending for 10 years, you know, as far as the civil case is concerned. And so it becomes very difficult for us to move forward and finally put it behind us and try to live our lives as best as we can, you know, because we're still battling this injustice. And as long as, you know, you have that, you know, it's hard. You know?
So at the end of the movie, it is mentioned that you filed a civil lawsuit in 2003. Here we are 10 years later. And so the status is that it's just not... It's moving forward, but not very quickly. Is that what's going on?
It's moving at a snail's pace. And what happens is that the city likes to use these stall tactics against us. You know, they have you fill out these waivers, and they want to go into your history. And you know, for us, they wanted like our medical records, our school records, you know, of a 14-year-old boy. And for my dad, they went back 25 years. And so they went and looked at all the doctors that he has seen in the last 25 years. And has he ever been on disability, social, you know, any type of workman's comp? And these are all these waivers that you have to fill out. And so that was one tactic they used against us. They also wanted what we had on our Facebook pages and our Twitter pages, and they still have access to those things. And then, you know, recently, you know, the last stall tactic they used against us was to subpoena, you know, Sarah, Ken, and Dave's work on the film, you know, all the notes and the outtakes. So this is something that we have been battling now for 10 years.
David McMahon, you received cooperation from the Central Park Five and their families, but you did not receive cooperation from the police or the prosecutors. Did the reason they give you for this have to do with the fact that this civil lawsuit continues, or why did they tell you that they wouldn't talk?
Well, to add to what Raymond said, the first time that they actually engaged us was by serving us with this subpoena for our notes and outtakes, but back up a number of years, all the way to the time that Sarah was writing a book, and she requested interviews with the prosecutors and police who were involved in the case, and they denied her an interview. And in some cases, they hid behind the civil suit, saying they hadn't been deposed yet, and they'd been advised by lawyers not to speak with with Sarah or with filmmakers or anyone telling the story. But in reality, I think that they probably couldn't answer the questions that we would ask them. And so therefore, you know, they elected not to participate. But they're not alone. We reached out to the media, members of the press who had written the sort of things that savaged these guys and it used dehumanizing language to describe them in 1989 with no real curiosity about who they were, the sort of families they came from, and what their lives were like before this night. We reached out to Donald Trump, who spent 80,000 of his own precious dollars taking out advertisements in the four major dailies saying, bring back the death penalty. These were children. We don't have any laws where the death penalty applies to juveniles. And so there were a lot of people who elected not to talk to us, but as Raymond said before, the subpoena was another way they could keep the case out of the courts, and so that was a way that they chose to engage us.
Sarah Burns, you wrote a paper about this in college. It became a book, as David just mentioned, in 2011. Do you remember it when it happened in 1989, and how did you get involved, and then how did you garner the trust and the cooperation of Raymond and the other four young men?
I wasn't aware at all of this case in 1989. I was six when it happened. And I didn't live in New York. And so I first learned about it in 2003 when I was a college student and I was thinking about law school. And I spent a summer working for a civil rights lawyer. And he was getting involved in the civil suit. Hadn't even been filed yet. And that's when I learned about the case, and I met Raymond and Kevin that summer. And I became fascinated by this story, and it felt like such an important story and one that I didn't know anything about. And it also fit with what I was studying in school. I was majoring in American studies. And so I went back and wrote my paper, my senior essay, about the racism in the media coverage of this case. But that wasn't the whole story, and I loved that project so much. I mean, it was such a fascinating part of a story that I sort of felt that I had to later on come back to it and try to tell the whole story. And as I started working on the book and doing interviews, I had to sort of become a journalist and started talking to the five and their family members and people who knew about the case and journalists and sort of getting the human side of the story, the emotional side of it as well. I started to get to know these guys. And I think that they all, as Raymond said, were interested in telling their story and having their story told. And so they all agreed to participate basically from the beginning. But it took some time over the course of those years that I was working on the book, I think, for them to become more comfortable about talking about this, to open up a little bit about the more difficult stuff. And so the great thing about having that groundwork, I think, was that by the time we interviewed them for the film, there was a sense of trust. And that is, I think, why these interviews that are in the film are so powerful and so open and honest and really moving, I think.
And Raymond Santana, I would imagine that that was a big risk for you as well. I mean, the police and the prosecutors were not the only people who wronged you. The media wronged you. So what was it that led you to believe that Sarah and Ken Burns and David McMahon would give you a fair shake?
You know, like Sarah said, we met back then and you know, when she came back and proposed the book, nobody else proposed to do a book. And so we took a chance, you know, but as we got to know Sarah, you know, and Sarah did her research, she went and she found all these facts that always was there, but people just choose to ignore them. And so, you know, in our conversations, you know, she would point out these facts and we was like, wow, this is exactly what we need. Somebody to just step up and tell the truth. And here was this woman who didn't have to do it. She could have went to law school and been a lawyer, but instead she said, you know what, this is an injustice and I'm going to stand and take, you know, I'm going to take a stand and I'm going to fight. And we applaud that.
And David McMahon, where are the safeguards to prevent this kind of thing from happening again? Are they, you know, should we have confidence that at some point they can rest with the police and prosecution who simply will clean up their act? Or will it be with the media? Will it be with documentary filmmakers? Where is it going to be? Where can we turn for folks to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again?
Well, I think there are a number of measures that can be taken. One is that what you see in the film are these videotape statements that four of the five made. They were the product of 30 hours of intense interrogations. And so they had worked after breaking the guise, to get a sort of script down that they then could tell to the prosecutor and have it be videotaped. That's what was played to the jury, and that's what sunk these guys. There was no forensic evidence, but it was too hard for anyone to understand why anybody would have given an account of a crime that they didn't commit and falsely confessed to it. And so what we need are safeguards to prevent that from happening. And one thing we can do is videotape interrogations from the very beginning. So when you bring suspects in, you turn on those cameras, and you roll right away, and then we know what went into getting those confessions. Another thing we can do is provide support for juveniles who are brought in. So they have somebody there looking over the shoulders of the people who are handling these processes and making sure that it goes well and that they're properly represented. And another thing is that we can have conversations at home to make sure that everybody knows their rights. So if they end up in a situation like this, they know, maybe I don't say anything until my parents arrive, until a lawyer arrives. I don't know how I ended up in this situation, but I know not to say anything until I'm sort of properly represented.
Filmmakers David McMahon and Sarah Burns directed and produced the documentary film The Central Park Five, along with Ken Burns. Raymond Santana was one of the Central Park Five. We spoke at a screening of the film in January. The film will air on Maryland Public Television Tuesday night at 9 o'clock. Sarah Burns and David McMahon, along with Raymond Santana and another of the Central Park Five, Corey Wise, will be back in Baltimore on Wednesday night, May 1st. They'll be screening the film and taking questions at Goucher College. Come to our website, WIPR.org, for more information. On 88.1, you've been listening to the Maryland Film Festival WIPR Spotlight. Throughout the year, we bring filmmakers and other experts together to screen and to discuss important movies. This edition of the Spotlight is also part of our year-long series, The Lines Between Us, which examines inequality in our region and which you hear every Friday here on Maryland Morning. We've got a dedicated website for the series. Come to linesbetweenus.org and tell us your stories and hear stories from other listeners. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.